Hi, everybody. This week, we're going to be moving from the questions of free will and divine modes of justice to a new topic, the topic of divine intervention and providence, questioning how and when does Hashem decide to interfere in the world, and how are we to understand the phenomenon of miracle making? There's a quote that's attributed to Einstein, and he might not have said it, which I think to some extent lies at the heart of our shiur, which states there are only two ways to live your life. One is as though nothing is a miracle. The other is as though everything is a miracle. Where does the Torah stand on the question? Are we supposed to be looking at the world around us as if it is totally miraculous? Or is it okay, or perhaps even preferable, to see just natural law at play? Or perhaps, are we supposed to find some happy balance between the two? Anyone that's looked at Tanakh knows that it's replete with descriptions of miracles. From the flashy miracles of the Ten Makot, the splitting of the sea, the man falling from heaven, getting water from a rock, to much more mundane miracles like those that are accomplished by Eliyahu and Elisha, the sweetening of a bitter stew, the retrieving of a lost axe, the feeding of 100 people with just one loaf of bread. Some of these miracles are overtly supernatural. Other miracles, less so. Some of the miracles target the nation as a whole. Others target just the individual. And it makes us question, how, when, and why does Hashem intervene into the world? Does Hashem make miracles for everybody? Can anybody merit a miracle? Or does Hashem reserve miracles for the most part for the nation as a whole? When does Hashem suspend natural law? And when does Hashem utilize it in making miracles? What's the exact balance between nature and miracle anyway? I think that most of us tend to think of miracles as being of major spiritual significance. After all, they attest to God's providence in the world, Hashgacha. They're proof that Hashem is still directly involved in the world. The word for miracle in Tanakh is actually an ot, a sign. It's a sign that Hashem is involved in the world. It's a sign that we can recognize Hashem's hand. The later word for miracle that we use today is nes. And interestingly, in Tanakh, not actually, I'll share my screen just so you can see this for a second inside. Okay. In Tanakh, the word nes means a standard, an ensign, a signal or a sign, a banner. Okay? And if you looked in a concordance at all of the usages of it, that's exactly what it says. Put this on a nes, put this on a banner. V'nasa nes lagoyim, and you should lift up an ensign to the nations from afar, right? So the word nes is a sign. The word for nes in Tanakh for a miracle is an ot. It's a sign of divine providence. It's a divine sign of Hashem being involved in our lives. And so most of us have no desire to minimize miracles. The opposite. We're quite happy with the phenomenon of miracles, and we wish that there were more of them. What we're going to see throughout this year, though, is that not everybody is so comfortable with miracles. And that not everybody feels that way. And the question we're going to have to ask, of course, is why? What could possibly be wrong with a miracle? What we're going to do in the rest of this year is start by looking at two miracles in Tanakh, the miracle of the splitting of the sea and the miracle of the stopping of the sun in the time of Yehoshua, looking at an array of mifarshim, an array of commentators, some of who embellish the miracle and have no problem with it whatsoever and make it into a greater miracle than what it appears at first glance from the text, all the way to those who suggest that this event might not have been miraculous at all and is simply the working of nature. Afterwards, we're going to look at around three theological or philosophical issues that might lie at the heart of the debate, that might lead someone to either say, no problems at all with miracles, or somebody else to say, no, miracles are not such a simple thing. So let's start with the miracle of the splitting of the sea. I'm going to share my screen again. And we'll look at the psukim inside, and then we'll look at some of the mefarshim. So the miracle is described in Shmot Yudalit, as you all know, where Bnei Yisrael are running away from Paro, and Hashem tells Moshe to stretch forth his hand, Vayit Moshe et yado hayam, and Moshe puts forth his hand over the sea, Vayolech Hashem et hayam beruach kadim azak kol halayla. And Hashem let out the sea with a mighty east wind, Vayasan et hayam lacharaba, Vayibaku hamayim, he makes the sea into dry land, and the waters are split. And then we're told that Bnei Yisrael come through the sea on dry land, and the waters are for them a wall on their right and their left. For most of us, this is a very obvious miracle, a very big, obvious suspension of nature. And what we'll see is that some commentators agree and make it into an even bigger miracle. Some commentators, though, disagree. So let's start with the Midrash, okay, which suggests, here, let me move this so we can see my screen a little bit better. The Midrash embellishes our miracle, and it suggests, sorry, let me just get to that source. Okay. I apologize. Okay. So Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer tells us that this wasn't just a miracle. It wasn't just the splitting of the sea, but it was a super miracle. Bo bayom nikfu hamayim, that day the waters froze, the nasu shnei masar chalakim, and they divided into 12 different portions, kineged shnei masar shvatim, each for one of the tribes, v'asu chomot mayim bin shviel l'shviel, and there was a wall between each pass, v'yu ro'im elot elo. According to Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer, the sea didn't just split into one lane for all of Am Yisrael, but 12 lanes, one for each tribe. And they could see each other from one lane to another. Shmot Rabbi adds, and just in case anyone happened to be hungry, if Abat Yisrael was overed bayam ubna b'yadav bocha, and she has a child who's crying and saying, "Ima, Ima, can I have a snack?" Uposhetet yadav v'notelet tapuach o rimon mitoch hayam v'notenet o. She goes and is able to go and grab from the trees that are growing in the yam, an apple or pomegranate to give him. And I just have a picture, if anyone happens to have this children's Haggadah, my daughter has it. You can see a nice little image of this. Bnei Yisrael crossing through the yam, able to see from one lane to another, pomegranate trees, apple trees, etc. Okay. So the Midrash totally embellishes our miracle, adding lanes, adding fruit trees, all things that are not in the text. Other people, though, suggest that maybe the miracle of Kriyat Yam Suf was a miracle mixed with nature. And so Shadal Shmuel David Luzzatto, a 19th century Italian commentator, tells us, Kriyat Yam Suf, lefi shehi mesuperet batorah, hayta ma'aseh nisim me'urav im ha'inyanim hativiyim. Says the splitting of the sea as told in the Torah is a miracle mixed with natural matter. Sherei im lo haya hakel rotzeh l'shtemish klal b'kochot hateva. He says, and proof is that Hashem wanted to utilize the forces of nature. Ruach kadim azal lama. If not, why does the text go out of its way to tell us that there was a ruach kadim azal, there was a strong east wind that Hashem brought all night long? Apparently, Hashem was utilizing that east wind, something in nature, in order to create this miracle. And he tells us that he quotes a theologian named Clericus that suggests that when Bnei Yisrael crossed through Yam Suf, they did so toward the northern edge near the Suez, and they did so b'sha'a shehu chozer la'achor u'mimav chasirim. They did so at the turning of the tide when the waters were waning. He says, and when Moshe stretched forth his hand and Hashem brought that east wind, it caused the tide to take a lot longer than normal to return to normal. And therefore, Bnei Yisrael had enough time to cross through. And he points out that this same, similar at least, event happened in Holland in 1672, describing some war between the British and people in Holland, where due to some strong winds, there was a lessening of waters for 12 hours, leading to a victory of Holland over the British. Okay. So here, Shadal's noting that the text itself suggests that this miracle wasn't purely miraculous, but it was a miracle mixed with nature. Okay. just so you should know, I'm not going to read the next verse. People are welcome to look at it inside. Yosef Rezavi, a modern chokher, talks about the splitting of the Jordan in a similar way, suggesting it too might have been a totally natural phenomenon, which also was attested to other times in history, pointing out that the Jordan didn't only split in the time of Yoshua. We have attestations to the Jordan drying up from a certain point and down in 1546 due to some type of an earthquake, which led to a buildup of debris, creating a dam, which then dried up the river below. And again, suggesting perhaps that's what happened when Bnei Israel crossed the Jordan. So already here we see some people embellish our miracles. Some people suggest it's a miracle mixed with nature, and others suggest perhaps it was a totally natural phenomenon. Moving to our second case, we're going to see a very similar spectrum. Did the sun really stand still? So again, in Yoshua Perek Yud, we're told that Yoshua is fighting against the Knanim, one of the battles against the Knanim. And presumably, in order to ensure that the Canaanites aren't able to make it back to their walled cities before he finishes the victory, he asks Hashem, could you please extend the day that we'll have more light hours to fight so that we can have a total victory before they're able to escape back to their walled cities? Because once they go back to their walled cities, war is going to be much more difficult because they'll hide behind them and they won't come out again. And so what did Yehoshua say? So let's share the screen and read the psukim inside. How do I minimize this? I don't know. Here. Okay. As Yidaber Yoshua Lashem, then Yoshua says to Hashem, Biyom Teteh et Amori lefnei Bnei Yisrael, on this day that Hashem was delivering the Amorites before Bnei Yisrael. Biyomer le'Bnei Yisrael, Shemesh v'givon dom, v'yareach v'imek ayalon. He asks Hashem, sun stands still in Givon, and the moon in the valley of Ayalon. And then we're told that's exactly what happened. Vayidom Hashemesh v'yareach amad. And the sun stood still, and the moon stayed, until the nation avenged themselves of their enemy. Here too, a lot of people either embellish this miracle or lessen it. So let's look again at an array of mefarshim on the topic. So Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer suggests that this miracle was not just the stopping of the sun for a few hours, but for a full 36 hours. He suggests that the reason wasn't what I suggested before, that it was a necessity in order to win a victory, but rather, starting right after the ellipsis there, Higia Erev Shabbat, V'ra'a B'tzaratan Shi'Yisrael Shelo Yichalelu Et HaShabbat. It is what prompted this miracle. It was Erev Shabbos, and Bnei Yisrael didn't want to fight over Shabbos. So he asked Hashem, could you extend the day so Bnei Yisrael won't have to fight over Shabbos? V'amad kol achad b'mkomo 36 sha'ot ad motzei Shabbat. For 36 hours, the sun and the moon stood still. So here again, Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer is totally embellishing our miracle. One, by minimizing the need. And two, by saying this isn't just a few hours, but a full 36 hours. Others aren't so comfortable with that. And I'm going to read you a conversation that Ibn Balaam, an 11th century Andalusian commentator, relays with another contemporary of his, Ibn Jekatila. And he tells us, Ibn Jekatila ma'amin shashemesh lomda. Says, this commentator, Ibn Jekatila, doesn't believe that the sun ever stopped. Ela shah tachzir bilvad nishar. What does he believe? That the reflection of the sun remained, even though the sun had set. So he says, Pamachat Shalti, one day I asked him, Ha'ima tachzir hu'inenu tutsa'a miguf ha'korim roshem zeh, dehainu Hashem. She says, I don't get it. Isn't the reflection simply a result of the thing that causes that reflection, meaning the sun? And if the sun isn't there, then how is it possible that there's a reflection? Hishiv, Sha'anis kanu dafka ha'bihirutsha or nishar gamim ha'ma'or ne'alam. He says, that was the whole miracle. The whole miracle was that even though the sun had set, there was still a reflection. There was still light from the sun. So Ibn Balaam is not understanding this. He's like, Ibn Jakatila, if you're willing to say that there was a miracle, then why don't you just mention the miracle that was in the pasuk? Why are you changing the miracle that was in the pasuk? And Ibn Jakatila responds, Eini yachol ta'er li shehatnu aha nathmedet titakev atan. He replied, I can't fathom to myself that the planet's continuous movement would ever cease. And you wonder, what is he saying? That this is too big a miracle for Hashem? What does that mean? What do you mean you can't fathom that? So this is someone who has no problem with the concept of miracles. He's suggesting that there's a total miracle going on here, reflection of the sun, even though the sun's not there, but has a problem with the miracle and the text. Okay. Move on to Abarbanel. Abarbanel here is explaining what he thinks the Rambam says on the pasuk. So it's not Abarbanel's own concept, it's how he understands the Rambam. And what he suggests that the Rambam is saying is, again, there's a miracle, but not the miracle of the text. What does he suggest happens? That with an Or Mechudash, Hashem created this new entity of light that would enable them to fight for the rest of the day because now they have light. But again, the sun itself didn't stop. Instead, the light is replaced, this new light is replacing it. And Abarbanel says, and what's motivating the Rambam to say this? He says, what I think is motivating the Rambam is the concept that miracles and wonders have to be in proportion to the needs that require them. And the idea of wreaking havoc with the entire solar system, he says, is totally disproportionate to the need. Instead, he says, yes, there was a more minor miracle proportionate to the needs of the people at the time. Okay? Moving down in our spectrum, I have another opinion that doesn't just minimize the miracle, but suggests that this is really nature at play. This is the Hol Moshe quoting a different scholar. So Hol Moshe, again, is an Italian parshan from the 19th century. And he tells us in the name of a certain scholar named Yosef Barzilai, who assumed Shaita Lakut HaShemesh. This scholar suggests that there was a solar eclipse that day. So as opposed to what we've been saying, that Yoshua was looking for more light, he suggests that Yoshua wanted darkness so that the enemy wouldn't be able to see. And he reads the word Vayidom HaShemesh to mean that the Shemesh was darkened, that the sun was darkened, which etymologically might be slightly problematic. And that the Areya Hamad, what does it mean that the moon stood still? The moon stood in front of the sun, blocking the sun's light. So the Hol Moshe himself has actually a lot of problems with this from a totally, from a reading of the text. And I think that that's a big question that one has to ask, is totally ignoring the theological and philosophical issues. Does this work with the text? And not so easily, because if the sun and the moon are two different places, one is in Gibeon and one is in Emek Ayalon, how could you possibly say that there's a solar eclipse and one is covering the other? And when it says below at lavo kiyom regil, and it didn't hurry to set like a regular day, does not sound like it's a solar eclipse. But what the Hol Moshe brings this opinion for is because he does think that there's some merit in looking for natural explanations. And I didn't put this on the score sheet, but I'm going to share the screen for a second, just because I think it's really important to see what he says. He says, "Be'emunah b'niflot Hashem humei karada." So Hol Moshe believes that belief in miracles is one of the fundamentals of our religion, one of the foundations of belief that we're supposed to have. Okay, and he says that if you don't believe it, that's a problem, because it's as if you're saying that in lakel yecholet, that Hashem doesn't have the ability, and we don't believe that. Of course, Hashem has the ability to bring miracles. But then he adds over here, Mikol makom, nonetheless, im nuchal yashiv hadavar beofen she'emunat taskimim hachachmot v'toratan hayoter brurot, hinei ma tov u'maneim. He says, but nevertheless, if we could somehow explain a miracle to make it work with science, to make it work with our understandings of nature, even better. And he says, and alkein hishadlu gam ma'aminim v'er haneseh al derech hatav. And he says, and that's why so many believers also try to read this miracle as working through nature. And he says, and don't think that I'm not the chorus for saying this. Don't think that I'm doing this because I don't believe in Hashem and I don't believe in his ability to do miracles. He says, ki bashamayim edi, right? Let the heavens testify, she'in kavanati laharos. My intention is not to destroy, rak livnot, but rather to build. And I think that's important, is that we're reading all these mefarshim who are somehow minimizing miracles. And one might say, oh, wait, that parshan like doesn't care, doesn't believe in Hashem's abilities. Hol Moshe is saying it's not coming from there at all. right? My intention is to increase belief, not decrease belief. And again, what we'll have to see is, why do they think that it's going to increase belief? Why do they have a problem with reading it according to the simple sense of the text? Moving to one last approach on the story. Is those that suggest that there's no miracle here at all. So Rabag and others suggest that perhaps this description of the sun standing still is all from the perspective of Am Yisrael. They had been able to accomplish so much that day that they felt as if the day stood still, as if it was extended. Or from modern scholar Ruth Walfish writes an article in a journal called Megadim, where she suggests that Yehoshua's tefillah was a tefillah of thanksgiving, not a tefillah in the middle of battle. And if so, this is just simply a poetic flourish, suggesting that Hashem, that Yehoshua is thanking Hashem and suggesting Hashem was with us, all of the forces of nature were with us as if the sun stopped still, etc. So we see a whole array of opinions here for each of our miracles, and you could take this for almost like every miracle in Tanakh. On one end, those that embellish the miracle, and on the other hand, those that minimize it. And again, we have to ask, what are the factors that are leading to the two sides of the debate? I want to start with a first factor, which are beliefs regarding the immutability of nature. Is natural law fixed, or can it be changed? What does the Torah believe? Okay, so on one side of the spectrum, let me share my screen. Okay. On one side of the spectrum, those that have no problem whatsoever with miracles suggest, of course, natural law can be utilized, molded, or suspended at Hashem's will. Since Hashem is the one who created the laws to begin with, of course he can change them as he sees fit. And in fact, it's the very existence of miracles which attests Hashem's role as creator. The Ramban and his Pirush Tishmot Perek Gimel Pasuk Tev Zayin discusses this at length. The Pasuk is the mitzvah of tefillin, and in the Pasuk here, actually, let me share the Pasuk inside. I forgot to put it on the source sheet. One sec. Okay. So here, V'hayah la'ota yedcha u'letotafo b'neinecha, right? The mitzvah of tefillin, you should have it as a sign on your hand and as bands between your eyes. Why? Because Hashem took us out of Egypt with a strong hand. So this pasuk seems to be suggesting that one of the reasons, at least, that we wear tefillin is that it's supposed to somehow commemorate the miracle in Egypt. And Ramban uses this pasuk as a starting point for a whole discussion on all the various mitzvot that are explained as being in commemoration of some type of a miracle. And he questions, why do we have so many chagim, so many mitzvot, that are meant to remind us of A, B, or C miracle? And he suggests that this must imply that there's some special significance to miracles. And what is that significance to miracles? The fact that miracles attest to Hashem's role as creator. So let's see that inside. He says, "Hashem yitzeh halukim be'ida o b'yachid." When Hashem favors an individual or group, and he makes for them some wonder by overturning nature, that wonder attests to the fact that Hashem was the original creator, because only the original creator can overturn nature. He's all-knowing, he's providential, and he's all-capable. And just so you should know, the Ramban talks about this in another, avenue, in talking about the differences between the Aseret HaDibrot in Shemot and in Dvarim. He notes that there's a different reason given for keeping Shabbat. In one, we're told you keep Shabbat to remember, because Hashem is a creator. And the other one, what's the reason given for keeping Shabbat? It's supposed to attest to the miracles of Yitzhak Mitzvah. And Ramban says, this isn't a contradiction. This is one and the same. Because the miracles of Yitzhak Mitzvah, the fact that Hashem was able to overturn nature during Yitzhak Mitzvah, is proof that Hashem created the world. And so really, both versions of the Aseret Hadibot are giving the exact same reason. The mitzvah Shabbat is attestation of the fact that Hashem is creator. Overturning nature, creating miracles, is attestation that Hashem is a creator. Ramban then discusses this further, and he points out that in the world and in the Torah, you don't only have those overt, very obvious supernatural miracles, but we also have a lot of what he calls hidden miracles. Miracles that you can mistake for being natural events. And he points out, for example, every day we say in the Shema that if we keep the mitzvah, what's going to happen? Rain is going to come down. And he says, if you think about it then, every time that there is rain, that is a supernatural phenomenon. Why? Because we're saying that what's the reason that rain is coming? Rain is coming as a direct result of my action, not because of the climate, not because of anything else, but rather because this is how Hashem is intervening in the world to make sure that I get my reward for having done my mitzvah. And if so, he says, then almost everything that's going on in the world is a direct result of divine intervention and is miraculous, to the extent that one might say that there's really no such thing as natural law at all. And just to see that in the Ramban inside. Let me share. So the Ramban says, "Umin hanisim hagdolim," and from those great open miracles, "Adam modeh benisim hanisarim," we can learn about also the hidden miracles, "Shehen yisod ha-Torah kula," which constitute the foundation of the entire Torah. "She'ein la'adam chelek b'Torat Moshe Rabbeinu, Ad shia amin, shekol dvarenu mikrenu kulam nisim, ein behem teva umin hagol shel olam." He says that one must come to the conclusion that every single thing, all of the world's words, and all of the events in the world are miraculous, there being no natural or customary way of the world in them. Everything is really miraculous. There's no such thing really as natural law, because everything that happens is a direct result of Hashem's intervention in the world. There's a beautiful story in the Gemara in Tanit, which I think gets across the same main idea. And it talks about Rabbi Hanina ben Dosa and his daughter. So Rabbi Hanina ben Dosa in the Gemara is sort of known as this miracle maker. And we're told, Chad Beishimshei, one Shabbat evening, Rabbi Hanina ben Dosa sees his daughter that she's sad. And he asks her, why are you so sad? And she answers, Kli shel chometz nitchalef li b'chli shel shemen. She said, by accident, I mixed up and confused a vessel of vinegar with a vessel of oil. Nidlati mimenu or the Shabbat, and I went and I lit the candles for Shabbat with my vinegar. Amarle, BT, he says to her, my daughter, Mayach Patlach, what are you so worried about? What are you so concerned about? Misha Amar la Shemen Vidlok. Hu Yomar la Chomet Vidlok. He says, he who told the oil to burn can just as easily tell the vinegar that it should burn. He says, you think that vinegar burning is a miracle? Vinegar burning is no greater a miracle than the fact that oil can burn. Everything in the world is a miracle. The fact that there are flowers outside is a miracle. The fact that the world runs as it does is a miracle. That line between nature and miracle, he says, doesn't really exist. If you could say that oil can burn, you could just as easily say that vinegar can burn. Everything, he says, is a miracle. Not everyone agrees, though. And not everyone is at all comfortable with this concept that Hashem can suspend natural order whenever he wants. We're going to look on this other side of the debate, starting at a midrash from Shmot Rabbah, who places this point of dispute in the mouth of Moshe Rabbeinu himself. Moshe Rabbeinu, according to the midrash, is going to be arguing with God about the idea of Hashem overturning nature. And so the Midrash opens with that right before Kriyat Yamsu, the Nation are waiting by the sea, and Hashem tells Moshe to split the sea. And let's see what the Midrash says is Moshe's reaction to Hashem's request. So in Shmot Rabbah, on the pasuk that we were looking at beforehand, we're told, "Bata haremet matcha, go and lift forth your staff." Amar Moshe lifnei Hakadosh Baruch Hu. When Hashem tells him to go and stretch forth his hand over the sea, Moshe turns to Hashem and he says, "Ata omer li she'akra tayam ve'aseh tayam yavasha." Are you telling me that I should split the sea and I should turn the waters into dry land? Okay, Bnei Yisrael are waiting with the Mitzrim right behind them, right? The Egyptians are running after them. Hashem saying, I have a solution to the problem. I'm going to split the sea. And Moshe sits there and argues with God, according to the Midrash, telling Hashem, are you really going to split the sea? But what's Moshe bothered by? Bahakti, asher samti chol gvulayam. In Yirmiyah, we have a pasuk that says that Hashem made the sands a border for the oceans. And Moshe says, hare nishvata she'inata kor'o la'olam. Moshe turns to Hashem and he says, Hashem, you fixed the laws of nature. And in so doing, you swore that nature is nature. And if this is water and that is dry land, you can't split the waters to create dry land because you promised that natural law doesn't change. That you're never going to split the sea because the sea is supposed to be sea. And we see that Hashem actually does say that. In Bereishit Perek Chet, we read, Od kol yemei ha'aretz zera v'katzir, v'kor v'chom, v'kaitz v'choref, v'yom v'layla lo yishvotu. Hashem tells us that natural law is going to stay and not cease. While the earth remains, sowing and harvest season, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not stop. Moshe says to Hashem, you said you set natural law and it's not supposed to change. And similarly, we read in Kohelet, Ma shehaya hu sheyeh, what was is what will be. What was done is what will be done. There's nothing new under the sun. Taking to mean there can't be new entities. Nature stays as it was from the very beginning of time. And I want to share something also that I didn't put on the source sheet. This fascinating midrash. Or story, I guess. I don't know exactly what you want to call it. Which talks about a person whose wife died soon after childbirth, and the man was destitute. You know, actually, let's look at it inside so you can have a text in front of you while it reads. Hold on. Let me just move this so we can find it. Okay. Tenu Ramanan. Maseh b'achad shemita ishto. There was an incident where a man's wife died and she left him a son. But he didn't have enough money to hire a wet nurse. And a miracle occurred and he developed breasts as if he was a moon. And he was able to nurse his own son. And then we get the reactions of two rabbis to this incident. Amar Rav Yosef, Bo re'e kama gadol adam ze shenasa lo nes kaseh. He says, look at how great this person is that a miracle of that magnitude was performed on his behalf. Amar le Abaye. Abaye responds, adrab, on the contrary, kama garua adam ze shenishtanu lo sidrei b'reishit. How dishonorable is this person that the order of creation was altered on his behalf. Abaye looks at this miracle and he says, the need for nature to change is evidence of not that everything is not correct, that there's something wrong here. There's something wrong about nature having to change. We wonder what's bothering these people. Why would someone say that nature can change? So yes, we understand that Hashem set natural law, but why can't he override it? So for this school of thought, the idea is that Hashem is unchanging and therefore, if he set nature, it too must be unchanging because it's nature, not miracles, that attest to the perfection of God's creation. And if we're going to suggest that we need to make a miracle and change natural law and change God's original creation, that suggests that the original creation must have somehow been imperfect. it suggests that when Hashem originally created the world, he didn't think through everything that was going to be necessary for later on, so that he has to change something from the original creation. And they say, no, nature should not change. Hashem fixed it. It's supposed to remain as was. And this leads a whole bunch of mainly rational Jewish thinkers to suggest that no, Hashem does not normally change nature. And just to see the Rambam and the Rabbag, so the Rambam are, you know, as might be expected, Rabbag, Rabbi Levi ben Gershom, a 13th century Provençal commentator, also a major, major rationalist, probably more rationalist than the Rambam. Both of them say, Harazon haya b'sheshit yimei ha-brishit, b'sheyim shechu ha-dverim kulam al til'am tamid. Says the desire was that from the 6 days of creation, matters would continue by their nature forever. And then he quotes the pasuk that we read in Kohelet, as it says, "Ein kol chadash tachat Hashemesh." Rabbag similarly, "I efshar shetishtaneh hateva mimin hagav." It's impossible that nature can change from its custom. Hinei be'er shelo yitachin sheyitchadesh al derech hamofet imlo ma sheyitachin sheyitchadesh al haminhag hatevi ba'orach hazman. It's not logical that something can be created by a miracle unless it could be created in a natural way over time. And so one wonders, do the Rambam and the Rabbag like not allow for miracles at all? Do they say the fact that nature is not supposed to be changing means that there's never a time that God can intervene and create a miracle? So they definitely both minimize miracles. They definitely try to read many of the stories in Tanakh that appear to be miracles as perhaps being something else, or at least minimizing the miracle, with Rabbag basically suggesting in many cases that what seems to be a miracle is really simply natural processes speeded up, or perhaps nature, you know, taking, you know, some natural phenomenon where the miracle lies in its timing and in the fact that it's being done just for Bnei Yisrael right when they need it, etc. The Rambam's a bit more muted, and he allows, I think, for a bit more what we might call obvious miracles, as long as nature reverts to the way that it was afterwards. Okay? So this whole school of thought then are quite uncomfortable with the idea of Hashem suspending natural order, and therefore they minimize miracles or suggest that miracles are just a manifestation of natural law, you know, being speeded up or something like that. There's also in between position, which the Rambam himself takes in other places, which is the answer that we're going to find Hashem responding to Moshe in the Midrash that I started with. Okay? So in the continuation from Shemot Rabbah that we looked at beforehand, after Moshe said to Hashem, "What do you mean you want me to split the sea? Didn't you say you're never going to split it, that natural law is fixed?" And Hashem responds, "Amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu, lo karata mitchilat ha-Torah maktiv." Didn't you read what it says in the beginning of the Torah? "Vayomer Elokim yikavu hamayim." And a God said, "May the waters be gathered." "Ani hu shehitneit imo, kach hitneiti mitchila shani karel." It was I who made the original condition with them. So too, I made a condition from the beginning that I was with them. And then they bring a proof. Okay, so according to the Midrash, all miracles are pre-programmed into the original creation. Meaning what? That when Hashem created, for example, the sea, Hashem said to the sea, "I'm creating you as sea, that this is how you're going to work via nature, etc." But he simultaneously programmed into it the idea that at some point you're going to split. That during Kriyat Yamsuf you're going to split, during Kriyat Yadin the water you're going to split, etc., etc. He says, so too for every day of creation, whatever was created was created so that natural law would work, with also the exception. Okay? And so in this way, one gets out of this, you know, this conundrum, I guess, of how could Hashem's creation not have been originally perfect? Did Hashem not think through everything that was going to be necessary? Because we're saying that, yes, Hashem did think it through. Miracles were programmed into nature from the very, very, very beginning of creation. Hashem knew that this is going to be necessary. And so basically, if I do that, the exception proves the rule. Hashem built the exceptions into the rules of natural law. Okay. This comes up in a Mishnah in Pirkei Avot also. Many of you might be familiar with the Mishnah that talks about all the things that were created on Erev Shabbat being Hashmashot. All things that were created on Erev Shabbat at twilight. And the Rambam explains the Mishnah and Pirkei Avot along the lines of what we were just saying. So let me share the screen and we'll see that inside. So in Pirkei Avot, we have a whole list of things that were created at twilight. Pi ha'aretz, the mouth of the earth, meaning the mouth of the earth that swallowed Korach. Pi ha'be'er, the well that gave mine, that gave water to Bnei Yisrael in the desert. Pi ha'aton, the donkey of Bilam's mouth that was able to talk back to Bilam. Hakeshet, the rainbow. Haman, the man. Hamateh, the staff through which Moshe does all the miracles. Hashemir, the idea of that worm that was going to split the rocks that are going to be used for the Beit HaMikdash, etc. And then other people add other things along the line. And a lot of people question, what's the common denominator between all these different things? Why were they all created, Bein HaShemashot, why were they all created at twilight right before the first Shabbat of creation? And so many suggest the common denominator seems to be that these are all miracles. And what the Rambam says is, so why were they all created at twilight, Be'er Shabbat? He says, most miracles were programmed into each individual day of creation. There's some though that didn't fit. And so all those extra miracles that didn't fit nicely into one of the days of creation to be the exception to the rule of that day of creation were created at twilight of Erev Shabbat. And again, it cuts us out of this sort of oxymoron of you need miracles, but at the same time, you don't want nature to change. And so what do we say? They were pre-programmed into nature from the very beginning. That's our first theological issue that leads some to minimize miracles and others to embellish them. Questions or thoughts until now before we look at the second theological issue? Okay, so let's then move into our second issue. The second issue is the issue of different beliefs regarding divine providence. To what extent do we think, oh, sorry, Jennifer, I didn't see. If you raise your hand, I'm sorry, you must have been on the other screen.
So sorry, Jennifer, yeah, I was just, this is just, oh, you're just such a magnificent teacher. Thank you. This reminds me, especially the last couple of Midrashim, that I think it was Stephen Hawking, I'm not sure, but somebody way up there like that said that for the universe to be boundless, that everything's equal and opposite. Maybe it doesn't have to be equal, but its opposite must exist because eventually if you're headed in only one direction, you're going to run out. So this idea of the sea, he creates the waters, but then the opposite is almost implied that he can then part the waters. It's interesting.
So that's an interesting formulation of the same idea. Nice. Mm-hmm.
Can I just say something? I don't understand why the Midrash needed to embellish the miracles. To me, that's so silly, you know, to say that there were not 12 lanes and that there were, I don't think it's a pretty Midrash at all. I just think it sounds ridiculous.
It makes me
very, very annoyed with the rabbis for, wasn't that a miracle enough without them having to add all this silly nonsense into it? I mean, obviously,
So obviously there's a reason that we're having, you know, an array of opinions out there as to how to view miracles. I think people that are on that side of the embellishing of the miracle is coming from a point of looking at these miracles as being attestations of divine providence and of being a special spiritual significance. And so the more you embellish the miracle, the more you're saying and showing God's providence, God's abilities, God's capabilities. And if the whole point of the miracle is to teach people about Hashem, you want to present Hashem as doing the utmost that Hashem could do. So I think that's where it's coming from. In some cases, it might be, and in the case that I've read, I'm not so sure there's a textual hook. It could be that in some of the other cases, there's some textual hook that someone is touching upon. Again, I don't know if in the case that we looked at, that one is going to be able to find the textual hook for there being like fruit trees in the middle of the sea. But again, I think it's coming from a very strong desire to make a miracle an attestation of Hashem's strength. And if so, you want to do that to the largest degree possible. Okay.
And it's not meant to be
is this issue
literally. You don't have to take Midrashim literally.
For sure. That's what I'm saying, right? So I don't know if, I don't think the Midrash's point is to say that there were actual trees as much as showing the strength and capabilities of God, right? And that's 100%, right? That many Midrashim might have a message, and it might not be, you know, whether it's historical truth that someone was able to develop breath or not, is much more the message that lies behind that story. Okay, so our second issue is, to what extent is the world run by divine providence and hashgacha pratit, where every single thing...
One more question.
I'm sorry, what?
I think you have one more question before we move on.
Okay, so the truth is, I think what, I'm looking at the time. We're going to hold that last, the next question, I apologize, to the end, because otherwise we're going to miss like two important points, I think. Okay? So, to what extent do we think that the world is run by Hashgacha Pratit, by individual divine providence, that Hashem guides everything in the world? To what extent do we say that there's room for happenstance, for chance, for Hashem not to be running every single thing directly? So here too, we have an entire spectrum, and I'm not going to nearly touch on all the different variations of the opinions out there, but I want to show basically two main sides. So again, let me share the screen. Okay. On one hand, you have our people who are totally comfortable with the miraculous and suggest that the entire world is run by divine providence. So in the Gemara in Chulin Daf Zayin Amud Bet, we're told, Amar Rabbi Chanina, Rabbi Chanina tells us, "In Adam nokef et ba'om mamata, elem kin machlizim alav mamala." Rabbi Chanina says, a person injures his finger below only if they declare about him on high. You're not going to injure your finger unless Hashem is actively making you injure your finger. Hearing this from a much later source, Pinchas of Korach, a Hasidic master, a Tamid of the Dash of the Baal Shem Tov, says in very, very, I think, explicit language, a man should believe that even a piece of straw that lies on the ground does so at the decree of God. He decrees that it should lie there with one end facing this way and the other end facing the other way. Every single thing in earth is a direct result of Hashem's decrees and will, to the extent that if a piece of straw is lying to the right or to the left, that's because Hashem wanted to be exactly where it was. Okay? The Ramban, that from the one that we looked at earlier, we talked about the idea that if you believe in a system of reward and punishment, that rain is coming because I was good, or rain is not coming because I was bad. He says that idea leads one to the conclusion that there has to be constant divine intervention in the world, because otherwise, how could you have reward and punishment? Right? If Hashem is not constantly intervening to provide you with reward and punishment, then you're not going to have reward and punishment. That doesn't happen by chance. Okay? And so he says, like we saw beforehand, that even seemingly natural events are in fact hidden miracles and attestations of divine power. Okay, that's one side. That, yes, everything in the world is a direct result of God's decrees, of God's intervention. Hashem is constantly intervening in the world. There's constant hashgacha pratit for everybody. As above, not everyone is so comfortable with this. And the Rambam asks, I think, a very, very important question on this approach to divine providence. And he says, in the Mor Nevuchim, he goes through different understandings of divine providence. What we just said is his third approach that he brings there. And he says, the third opinion is those who say that there's no chance at all. So he says, and the direct consequence of a belief that there's no chance at all is the fact that every action of an animal, every action of a person is totally decreed by God, and you don't have in your power to either decide to do or decide not to do a specific thing. And he says, but if that's what you're going to say, we have a big problem, because what then happens to free will, right? If God's directing every action of mine, I don't really have free will. And not only that, what's the point of the Torah? Because if Hashem is going to be dictating that I do X or I do Y, then why do you bother giving me a Torah if I don't have the ability to either do what's commanded or refrain as commanded, because every action of mine is guided by Hashem? So this leads to many people suggesting that maybe Hashem does not run his world by constant divine providence. And a second question, which I think goes along with what we just said, is if you take Hashem to be totally good and totally ethical, and you then say that everything that on earth happens because of his will and by his hand, then how do you explain how and why evil exists in the world. And so this leads to a whole nother school of thought that says, no, the world is not generally run by divine providence, but rather by nature. And Hashem intervenes in the world, but not all the time, and not for everyone, and not for everyone equally. Okay? So this approach is, again, taken by a lot of our rationalists and a lot of, actually, Jewish thinkers. The Rambam, the Ramban, actually, even himself, and other sources, which is a big question how to, you know, basically reconcile the different sources in the Ramban. But we'll look at the Rambam. I actually should have put this on a different order in the source sheet because the Rambam comes before the Ran. But the Rambam says his understanding of how Hashgacha works, of how divine providence works, is that divine providence is in direct correlation to the perfection of man's human intellect. Okay, so I'm oversimplifying, I'm just warning you. This is total oversimplification of the Rambam. But what he basically says is that the more a person has perfected himself, and specifically his intellect, the more, quote unquote, in line with Hashem he's going to be and with, like, the, you know, the divine overflow. And therefore, he'll get more divine providence. The Ran says it's in, I think, a way that might speak to people better. He says that generally the world is run by nature, in his words, by the astrological system, but for moderns, I think we would say by nature. But Hashem has the ability to overturn nature when he wants. And when is it that he wants to? When will Hashem intervene in the world? When will Hashem have Hashgachat Pratit? According to somebody's deed. If you do Avodat Hashem and you fill your life with mitzvot, the more you do that, the more you'll deserve and merit divine intervention. But he says, if you don't deserve divine intervention because you don't have enough merit, well then yes, nature might run its course. And for example, that would explain Tzadik Varalo, because sometimes you don't merit a miracle for Hashem to stop some natural disaster from coming, and therefore you'll get caught up in the natural disaster. So for this whole school of thought then, most of the time, the world is run by nature. Not all of the time, but most of the time. And so if a person doesn't deserve a miracle, and you see a miracle happening in Tanakh, for example, you might decide that I want to reread that miracle as being much more natural than miraculous. Okay? And you'll be much more loath to suggest that everything is a miracle, because that's not how you think the world works. The world is generally run by okay. The Ramban has an actually interesting approach, again, that doesn't totally work with what we said beforehand. But he suggests that can seem lo yasu l'tova l'ra'a rak l'tzadikim gmurim o l'rishayim gmurim. So he takes a similar approach, but in a different way, where he says, in general, when does Hashem work miracles? For the nation as a whole. The nation as a whole merits miracles. Individuals in general do not merit miracles. When might someone merit a miracle? Either if he's a total Rasha or a total Tzadik. Okay? Then we might need intervention to either punish the Rasha in a sufficient way or to reward the Tzadik in a sufficient way. He might merit a miracle. Aval habinoni, most of us, those in the middle, for us, most of the time, the world runs in a natural manner. Okay? So again, this is a second approach where obviously depending on where you stand on that spectrum of whether you believe that Hashem acts totally with Hashgacha, that he's running every aspect of the world, then of course you're going to be comfortable with miracles. If though you think that there's such a thing as chance, that Hashem generally runs the world via nature, then of course you're going to minimize the miracle. Okay, one last set of issues really quickly. I'm just going to raise them. This comes up in Rabag and in others. One is a technical issue. We have a pasuk in Tanakh that describes Moshe Rabbeinu that says, "Lo kam navi od b'Yisrael kemoshe." There was never another prophet like Moshe. L'chol ha'otot v'moftim asher asa Moshe le'nei kol Yisrael, and specifically in what areas? In his miracle making. This pasuk leads some to minimize miracles, not because of major theological issues, but because if you see a miracle that seems to be greater than any of the miracles that Moshe did, for example, perhaps wreaking havoc with the solar system and having the sun stand still, or someone reviving the dead, both miracles which seem perhaps to be bigger than the miracles of, for example, bringing the Makot or splitting the sea, then you might feel the need to make sure that this pasuk is true, that no one rivaled Moshe. You might say, we must be reading that miracle wrong. It must be a more minimal miracle than we thought. Second, and this came up in the Barbanel beforehand, the idea of disproportionate miracles. According to Rabag, according to Barbanel, when does Hashem bring a miracle? As needed. That need might be physical, for like the physical survival and victory in war or something, or spiritual, in order to gain people belief in God. He says, but a miracle has to be directly proportionate to the need, which prompts it. And so if a miracle seems to not fit the need or the benefit that it provides, then you're going to reread that miracle. So just to give you an example, in this week's Parsha, we read about Eshet Lot, Mrs. Lot, that looked back, and then we're told that Tehi Netziv Melech, and she turns into a pillar of salt. So Rabat says, that's not proportionate. What do we need her to turn into a pillar of salt for, right? You want to punish her, punish her. You don't have to make a miracle to punish her, right? There's absolutely no need for it. So how did she read that pasuk? That she looked back, that Tehi, the land of Sodom, was a Netziv Melech. What did she see when she turned around? That the land of Sodom had turned into a pillar of salt or a mound of salt due to the devastation. Okay, just another variation of that, which is also interesting. Rav Yosef Bachor Shwer there also suggests that we're not talking about a miracle, but that she looked back. What does that mean? That she tarried, right? That she delayed. The reason she wasn't supposed to look back was because if you keep on looking back, you're not going to get far enough away from the city. You're going to get caught up in the devastation that's occurring in the city. And so she became a mound of salt. Not that she miraculously morphed into a mound of salt, but she got caught up in the devastation of the city. And she was covered with salt like everybody else was covered with, you know, whatever was raining down from Shemaim. And that's her punishment. So again, one's going to reread miracles if you believe that miracles come according to the need that drives them, be it spiritual or physical. And you see a miracle that doesn't make sense according to that. You're going to reread it and minimize it or suggest that it's not a miracle at all. So we've seen this whole spectrum, those that embellish, those that minimize, with basically three or four theological issues that are guiding the debate. One being, what are your beliefs about whether nature and natural law is fixed? Two, what are your beliefs about divine providence? To what extent does Hashem always run every aspect of the world? Three, what is the proportionality between miracle and the need for that miracle? And then finally, the more technical question of the superiority of Moshe's miracle. I want to end just where we began with that quote from Einstein. I really shouldn't be giving Einstein the last word, but whatever, where he questions, right, should you live your life as if nothing is a miracle? And obviously we have, you know, this debate between our commentators, but I think that within our commentators, they're actually both coming, meaning both sides of the debate are not as far apart as far as what the spiritual significance of what we're saying is going on. Those that say, yes, live your life as if everything a miracle, what are they saying? Look, see Yad Hashem and everything. Those that are saying, no, we don't want to, you know, we don't want to ignore natural law, but they're coming from the very same point. Because what does natural law do? Natural law for them attests to Yad Hashem. Natural law is how we see Yad Hashem in the world. And so according to both sides of the debate, what you really should be doing is looking and living your life with a desire to see Yad Hashem, be it in miracle or in nature. Okay. So our time's up. Anyone that wants to stay on and ask a couple questions, please feel free.
Yeah,
okay. Raise your hand or just call out because I can't see everybody on the screen.
I want to ask you a question. Sure. Regarding Lot's wife, are there two contradictory interpretations? One is that she saw that she
do me a favor, Ray, say that again because you're waking up on me.
I want to know about your interpretation of Lot, what happened to Lot's wife. Am I right in saying that there are contradictory explanations? One, that she understood why Sodom had turned into salt, and the other one is that she was destroyed just like the salt. Is that what you said?
No.
You're muted.
Okay. No, so the truth is, Mama, I just had to reconnect totally. I somehow got I somehow got bumped off the Zoom altogether. So whoever was in the middle of talking, I apologize. I did not hear your question. If you could just repeat it.
I'd like you to repeat what you said about Lot's wife. What are the two explanations?
Okay, so according to Rabag, when the Pasuk says that she looked back, but Tehi Netziv Melech, which we normally translated, and she turned into a pillar of salt. He says that Tehi means, and it, a feminine it, was a pillar of salt. What's the it? The Adama, the land of stone. When she looked back, she saw that Batihi Netziv Melech, that the land of stone had turned into a mound of salt, and that the Pasuk is not saying anything about Lot's wife getting punched. That was one explanation. Second explanation was of Rav Yosef Bechor Shor, who suggests that Batihi Netziv Melech does relate to Mrs. Lot. But what happened? Because she was looking back, she didn't move fast enough away from the site of the destruction. She tarried and delayed. And so that when destruction got what came on stone, she got caught up in the destruction of stone. And like the rest of stone, she was covered in salt and died the same way that everybody else died. So it's not a miraculous transforming into salt. It's that she got caught up in the devastation of the city, which meant that she was covered with salt.
Thank you. Those are two fantastic interpretations. I really appreciate that you taught me that.
Great.
But then according to the first interpretation, is she dead? Does she die?
Okay, so the truth. No, so according to the first interpretation, so the truth is Rabag actually does think that she died, but not from that pasuk. But one could totally read this and say that she didn't die. No one said that she should, when the Malachim tell her that she shouldn't look back, they don't say that if you're going to look back, you're for sure, at least I don't think so. I don't think they say that you're going to die. And it's, or if they're suggesting they're going to die, you're going to die because you're going to get caught up in the city, not as a punishment for looking back. In other words, the Malachim are giving good advice, not a, prohibition.
Right. I'm just thinking that the whole story of Lot and his daughters wouldn't happen if he still had his wife.
Right. So that's why most people do think that she died. Right. So whether or not it's a punishment or a natural consequence of tarrying, it makes sense. She doesn't seem to be in the rest of the story. Presumably she's not there. And if she's not there, one explanation is, well, she must have died. Which is why Rav Yosef Bechor Shor makes a lot of sense. Right. It's a natural explanation of her getting caught up in the destruction of the city. That's why she's dead. And that's why she's no longer in the rest of the story. But one doesn't have to posit this crazy miracle again, according to Rabag and Rabbanel, for no reason. Okay.
Could she be emotionally dying?
That's an interesting way of saying that. Maybe she's actually no longer in the picture because she's not functioning anymore. Due to the devastation, right? If you live through, your entire city being destroyed, that would be an interesting. I don't know of anyone that takes that approach, but it's an interesting idea. Yeah. By the way, if anyone's interested in the last two pages of the score sheet, I brought a bunch of examples of other miracles that people also explain in more natural ways for whoever is interested.
What you were saying, first of all, fantastic share. But what I wanted to ask you about is there seem to be two philosophies of when God creates a miracle, when the need is great enough, right? Mm-hmm. And when it affects the whole nation and versus helping individuals. And I don't know, maybe this is harsh, people who've gone through the Holocaust might not see it that way. But when you see the way that God did create a miracle for the whole nation and all the Jewish people, even the ones chutz la'aretz in creating the state of Israel, and almost everybody agrees that, fighting that many Arabs had to be a miracle. And people say, well, why didn't he create a miracle and save all these individual children that died in the Holocaust? Why didn't he save this individual tzaddik that died in the Holocaust? Maybe that's not when he would intervene, because they were, each person who died was just an individual, whereas creating the state of Israel was a powerful miracle for all of Yisrael or something.
Okay. Yeah. So some people might.
It's just something that occurred to me when you were talking about the two.
Right. No. So for sure, there's people that will say that there's going to be different divine providence for the nation as a whole than for individuals. I am nowhere qualified to explain why Hashem acted as he did in the Shoah, though. I don't have an answer.
Can I ask a question about the Rabbi Hanina ben Dosa midrash? It's a beautiful midrash, but it just made me think that if that's how the world worked in general, then you could never rely on oil burning and, you know, vinegar not burning. There has to be a certain natural order for the world to function. And, you know, the role that miracles play, we can discuss, but it can't be that, okay, you know, things are just going to change because, you know, the moment needs them to change, you know. Oil is supposed to burn. We can't live in a world where everything's so volatile that you can't rely on the nature of things. That's what I'm getting at.
For sure. Right. And that's why we have that whole concept of Ein Somchim Al HaNes, right? That we don't rely on miracles, right? Even someone who thinks that miracles happen all the time might not suggest that you live your life assuming that if I close my eyes and cross a major highway, that nothing's going to happen to me. No, because we assume that miracles might not happen. Even if they can happen, they don't happen all the time, right? You know, and Rabbi Hanina is more, I think, you know, like we said before, and obviously teaching the lesson of recognize the miraculous nature of nature, you know, more than I think saying rely on it.
Right.
You know? Thank you, everybody.
I want to ask you one other thing. Would you say that both approaches to miracles are Elu ve'elu Divrei Elokim? I mean, can you be Jewish and believe in either one?
Well, looking at all the people that are much, much greater scholars than me that take each side, I think you have Ami v'Smoch. You definitely have Ami, someone to rely on both sides of the debate. Rambam versus the Ramban are pretty big pillars to be hanging on.
Right.
Yeah, I don't think we can. Depend on miracles to exist. I mean, once you enter the land of Israel, we had to work with the land to eat. To when we were in the desert, it was different. There were miracles, but once we became independent, so you know, spiritually, we had to work. So just to say, we're going to believe in miracles. Of course, miracles happen constantly. But we can't depend on just living by miracles. We have to be a part of the whole process.
For sure. And the Netziv Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berliner in his Perush on the Midbar says, to some extent, what you were just saying, that there might be a divide between the time of the wilderness and then moving into Eretz Yisrael, where Hashem slowly weaned the people away from a total supernatural existence that existed in the desert to relying on nature when we got into Eretz Yisrael. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so if you look at his introduction to Sefer Bamidbar, you'll see a discussion.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, everybody. See you next week.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Very provocative. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Bye-bye.